I'm David Clark.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, good. We have someone on the phone. We'll have you identify yourselves in just a moment. I'm David Clark, one of the three commissioners. Next to me is Chairman Ron Allen. Next to him is Commissioner Thad Labar. I'm going to be acting as the hearing officer for our hearing today. This is the time and place duly noticed for hearing a hearing in two dockets. First, docket number 13035184, which is commonly referred to as Rocky Mountain Power's general rate case, and also docket number 13035196, which pertains to revisions to backup maintenance and supplementary power service tariff, electric service schedule 31. We're going to take the stipulation pertaining to the general rate case up first, and then the stipulation in the other docket will follow. We want to begin by having parties enter their appearances, identify their witnesses as they do so, and we'll begin first with those who are physically present in the hearing room, and then we'll have those on the phone who intend to participate identify themselves as well. So you're aware, after we have the council enter their appearances, we thought it might be useful to have a brief discussion of the scope of the hearing that will be held commencing July 28th, so that any who are present and participating for that purpose only can then go on with the other business that they have before them today, and then we'll take up the stipulations. If there's an objection to that, please let me know when you enter your appearances. Let's begin with the applicant, Ms. Hogle.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners, Chairman. My name is Yvonne Hogle, representing Rocky Mountain Power. With me here today is Mr. Dave Taylor, who will be presenting a summary of the settlement stipulation. Also with me today is Steve McDougall, who was a witness in the case, and he is available for any questions that you may have. On the phone with us today also are Joelle Stewart and Mr. Greg Duvall, for the same reasons.
Thank you. And just one preliminary item, Ms. Hogle. Pacific Corp had a motion pending before the commission. I'm assuming your intent is to withdraw that. Is that correct?
Rocky Mountain Power's intent is to request that the commission not act on that motion. So that would be our request. Thank you. And there's also another preliminary matter. I don't know if you want to take that up right now or wait until everybody introduces
Okay, let's come back to you as soon as we have all of the appearances.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Schmidt.
Good morning. Patricia E. Schmidt with the Attorney General's Office, representing the Division of Public Utilities. And with me as the division's witness is Dr. William Artie Powell.
Thank you.
Brent Coleman with the Attorney General's Office, representing the Office of Consumer Services. With me at council table is Michelle Beck, the director of the office, who will provide the office's position today.
Thank you.
Captain Jernigan, representing the federal executive agencies, and joining by phone, Mr. Myers is our witness.
Thank you.
Gary Dodge, on behalf of the UAE Intervention Group, and also on behalf of U.S. Magnesium, LLC. Kevin Higgins is available in the audience as a witness if the commission has questions of him on the general rate case stipulation.
William Evans for the Utah Industrial Energy Consumers, and I apologize that I have let my witness off this morning and don't have him available, but can call him on the phone and see if you have questions. I think I might be able to get him. We don't intend to offer any testimony from a witness.
Thanks, Mr. Evans. Anyone else who's here with us in the room?
Yes, sir, Mr. Commissioner. Peter Mathias on behalf of Nucor Steel. And we don't have a witness in the case. I'm just here as an observer today, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mathias. Anyone else?
Sophie Hayes on behalf of Utah Clean Energy.
Thank you. Anyone else? Those on the phone, would you please, if you intend to participate, identify yourselves and the party you represent.
This is Greg Duvall, Director of Net Cargos for
Thank you.
This is Bruce Plank. I'm an attorney appearing on behalf of staff.
In phase one, we submitted the direct testimony of Dr. Jeremy Fisher. Dr. Fisher is available by phone today if you have any questions for him. We also have phase two testimony, but I understand that that's not an issue today.
Thank you.
Well, this is David Woolley, also for Sierra Club.
This is Kurt Boehm appearing on behalf of the Kroger Company.
Meshack Rhodes appearing on behalf of Walmart.
Joelle Stewart, witness for Rocky Mountain Power.
Pardon me just a second. Did you have a question about a spelling of a name? Or
the first name? The spellings would be good.
All right. Mr. Coleman, can you help with? Okay. You've got them all in your records?
I think I have the one that she's.
Okay. Thank you. All right. We're going to continue, and it would help if you'd spell your name as you identify yourselves. For those who've already done that, we think we have the spellings on other documents here in the hearing room, and we'll make sure we have them correct in the record. So now back to those on the phone. Is there anyone else who would like to identify themselves?
This is Greg Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, consultant for the FEA.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you very much. Ms. Hogle, you mentioned you had a preliminary matter.
Yes, Commissioner. I just wanted to note that although the net metering issue in the cost of service phase is not at issue here today, Rocky Mountain Power would like to note that Rocky Mountain Power was never served with Mr. Michael Rossetti's representing UCARE. His testimony when it was due in June, I believe, and we noted that in the testimony that we filed just recently, and would like the opportunity to respond to that testimony in Sir rebuttal on the date that Sir rebuttal is due. I contacted Mr. Rossetti, knowing that he is not represented by counsel. He is representing UCARE on his behalf. And he indicated to me that that would be fine.
And as far as I'm aware, Mr. Rossetti isn't present today or on the phone. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hogle, for that representation, and on the basis of the representation, we'll permit the company to respond, as you've indicated.
Thank you.
I believe that assuming the stipulations that are before us are accepted, and things go forward as the parties plan, then the one issue that will remain for hearing in the week of July 28th will be the net metering issue. Is that correct? Is there any addition or correction to that statement that party would like to make. So that being the case, we note that the direct testimony of the parties has net metering testimony sort of commingled in it. And our thought would be, you've asked us to receive all of the testimony that's been provided or filed into evidence, and we would intend to do that today, but to receive all of the testimony and exhibits that pertain to the net metering issue provisionally, subject to any objections that might come before us in that hearing. Does any party have a comment on that process?
That's acceptable to the division.
Okay. And I'm going to assume it's acceptable to everyone else, given the silence that I'm perceiving. So, okay. Thank you. Next, is there anyone present or on the phone who intends to question witnesses that are going to offer testimony in support of the stipulation today, or is there anyone who intends to offer testimony in opposition to the stipulations, either of them? And that's as we expected. So what we would intend to do then is to hear the witnesses first for the general rate case stipulation as a panel, and we would have them make their individual statements in support of the stipulation, but then be subject to questions by the commission as a panel. Is there any objection or comment on that process? Okay. Any other preliminary matters that we ought to take up before we swear the witnesses who are going to offer testimony in support of the stipulation?
And,
to determine the witness sequence for the net metering hearing commencing on July 28th to allow for scheduling of out-of-town witnesses. Would you be inclined to, I'm assuming the order would be company, division, office, and then others. Is that the commission's intention with the net metering phase of the hearing?
That would be our typical practice and our intention, subject to an objection. And if it would be helpful to the parties to identify the order beyond that, we could attempt to do that now for a moment. Is there any opposition to taking a moment to consider order of witnesses for the hearing?
Mr. Commissioner, I think the parties probably could work that technicality or that administrative issue out amongst themselves. Not all of the parties to participate in the net metering portion of the case are present, and so I think it might be a little premature to try and address groupings or positions of presentation. So I think it might be more efficient to allow the parties an opportunity as a whole to work out the presentation order amongst themselves rather than here today.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Why don't we at least conclude that it would be company, division, and office, and then the order beyond that. Could we look to you, Mr. Coleman, and to the office generally to work with the parties and to assist them in achieving an order that accommodates their need to and desire not to have their experts unduly their time unduly taken up here?
Sure. I will be happy to spearhead that issue.
Yeah, thank you. That'll be very helpful, I
think. This is Bruce Plank. Thank you, Commissioner Clark. That's perfectly adequate for my witness, and I'd be happy to work with Mr. Coleman and the other parties to get that straightened out. And with that behind us, I would ask to be excused. My client's not interested in participating in the remainder of the hearing today.
Thank you for being with us for this opening segment. So which parties intend to offer witnesses in support of the stipulation? We have Mr. Taylor.
Green Mountain Power, yes.
Dr. Powell.
The office.
Ms. Beck. Anyone else? Then would the three of you please raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. And so let's, in that order of Mr. Taylor, Dr. Powell, and Ms. Beck, we'll you can make any summary statements you'd like to, and then we'll have questions. Ms. Hogel.
Can you please state your name and position with Rocky Mountain Power?
My name is David L. Taylor. I'm employed by Rocky Mountain Power as the manager of regulatory affairs for the state of Utah. My business address is 201 South Main, Suite 2300, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84111.
And what is the purpose of your testimony today?
I will briefly review the key elements that led up to this stipulation, as well as the significant elements of the stipulation itself. This was a stipulation in docket number 13-035-184. Referred to more frequently as the 2014 general rate case. Stipulation was entered into by 8 signing parties. I'll also reconfirm Rocky Mountain Power support of the stipulation and the company's belief that the stipulation is in the public interest.
Please proceed with a history of the events that led to the stipulation.
On January 3rd of 2014, Rocky Mountain Power filed a general rate case requesting an increase of $76.3 million. On January 22nd of this year, the commission issued a scheduling order setting a procedural schedule in 3 separate phases for cost of capital, revenue requirement, and cost of serving rate spread and rate design issues. Since that date, Rocky Mountain Power and intervening parties have filed several rounds of testimony in the case. And over the course of this proceeding, Rocky Mountain Power filed testimony of 18 witnesses that included over 2,400 pages of testimony and exhibits in support of its request. The intervening 13 intervening parties filed the testimony of 35 witnesses. In addition to 160 filing requirement responses that were provided with our application, the company also responded to over 2,400 data requests as the intervening parties prepared their responses to the company's case. I point this out just to show that prior to entering to settlement discussions, the company presented a significant amount of evidence in the case, and that the parties in the case have thoroughly reviewed all of that evidence and made determinations upon that review. Over the last several weeks, the parties in the case have engaged in settlement discussions, and based upon those discussions, the parties have reached an agreement to the terms and conditions that are set forth in the stipulation that's being presented before the commission today. In reaching that stipulation, various parties considered and relied upon a number of different factors and considerations. Included in that was the evidence that the company provided with its rate case filing, providing support for a 2-step rate increase. The parties considered the in-service date of the Sigrid Direct Butte transmission line and other timing considerations and other factors. In reviewing each of these issues, individual parties may have placed greater weight on different issues in getting comfortable with the agreement. I will let those parties present before you any of those issues that were of significance for them if they choose to do so. The signed stipulation was filed with the commission on June 25th of this year, and the settlement is intended to resolve most of the issues in the general rate case in accordance with the respective terms and conditions as laid out in the stipulation itself. The stipulation does not, however, resolve the net metering facilities charge that was proposed by the company as direct filing. That issue is ongoing and will continue on the schedule that was laid out by the commission. While not all parties in the case have signed the stipulation, we're not aware of any party that opposes it. And most of the parties that have not signed the stipulation are those who continue to be involved in the net metering issues in that portion of the case.
Mr. Taylor, can you proceed with the key terms of the stipulation?
Yes, I will. I'll walk through some of the key elements of the stipulation. I'm certain that the commission has read it, so I'll try to be brief as I touch on these terms. And in doing so, I don't intend to modify any of the terms of the stipulation in any way. And if by chance I misspeak, the language of the stipulation, not the words that I say, represent the binding agreement of the parties. As I walk through, I trust you'll let me know if I'm giving you too much or not enough detail as we go forward. So the parties agree and recommend that the commission approve the following. And we're now walking to paragraph 18 of the stipulation. They agree that a multi-year rate plan be established. A multi-year rate plan will provide a measure of rate certainty for customers, and that will also afford the company a reasonable opportunity to earn its authorized rate of return and recover its cost of service. With that, the multi-year plan includes the following components. Rocky Mountain Power should be permitted to implement a step one general rate case in the amount of $35 million to be effective September 1 of 2014. The parties have agreed that the Sigler to Red Butte transmission line investment is prudent, but cost recovery of that line will not begin until the step two rate change. The step two rate change, Rocky Mountain Power should be permitted to implement a step two rate increase in the amount of $19.2 million. That will include the cost of the Sigler to Red Butte line to be, and that increase will be effective on the later of September 1st, 2015, or the in-service date of the Sigler to Red Butte transmission line. If that transmission line is not in service by September 1 of 2015, the Step 2 rate increase will be delayed until the Sigler to Red Butte line is placed in service. In paragraph 23, Rocky Mountain Power is allowed to keep its currently effective 9.8% return on equity. The cost of capital, both structure and the rates of equity and debt, are shown in Table 1 of this stipulation, and that stipulated cost of capital will be enforced both through Step 1 and Step 2 of the rate plan. Moving on to paragraph 24, which discusses net power cost, base net power cost in the amount of $1,495.8 million annually on a total company basis, or $630 million annually on a Utah allocated basis, will become the base net power cost beginning on September 1 of 2014, in effect during step one of the rate plan. Table 2 in the stipulation shows the stipulated level of EBA cost. Now, those are both base net power cost less wheeling revenue. That's shown dollars per megawatt hour by month, and that will be the amounts used in the EBA measurement throughout of step one. Exhibit A to the stipulation provides the details of that dollar per megawatt calculation for EBA cost. It shows also how those EBA costs will be allocated among rate schedules, and that's based on the composite NPC allocator, which is also presented in Exhibit A. The EBA costs allocated to special contracts, whether or not they're included in these components in Exhibit A, will be subject to the terms of those contracts. And the monthly EBA costs shown in Table 2 will remain in place until they are reestablished in the Step 2 rate change. Base net power cost in the amount of $1,491.1 million annually on a total company basis, or $628 million annually on a Utah allocated basis, will be established for the base cost beginning September 1, 2015, or concurrent with the Step 2 rate increase. Those rates, as above, are shown in Table 3 below, and Exhibit B to the stipulation contains the same information as in Exhibit A, only as it relates to the Step 2 element of the rate plan. Moving on to paragraph 26, the parties request that the Commission approve an extension of the current EBA pilot. It's currently scheduled to end December 31, 2015. We requested that be extended for 1 year through December 31 of 2015. 16, excuse me. The parties also agree that the final report from the Division of Public Utilities on that EBA pilot, which currently is due within 4 months of the conclusion of the third year of the pilot, that report be extended for 1 year as well, so that it would be due within 4 months after the conclusion of the fourth calendar year of the pilot. The EBA findings will continue on their established schedule, subject to this one-year extension, as we've just discussed. Moving on to paragraph 27, effective November 1, 2014, all the deferral balances currently be collected in the EBA over there's three separate tranches with three separate amortization periods. Those amounts will be added together, and they will be combined with the approved balance from the currently pending EBA adjustment that in docket number 14-03531. All that total balance will be then collected over 1 year beginning November 1, 2014. The prior EBA balances will continue to be collected without interest during the collection period, but the Commission-approved balance from the pending EBA docket, again, docket number 14035-31, will accrue interest throughout the collection period unless otherwise ordered by the Commission or agreed to by stipulation in that docket. In essence, what this means, we're going to greatly simplify the collection and amortization periods of all these EBA tranches into a one-year amortization beginning in November of this year. Moving on to a discussion of Naughton Unit 3. For the purposes of the revenue requirement calculation in this case, Naughton Unit 3 is assumed to continue to operate as a coal-fired resource through December 31 of 2017. If the company does not obtain the amended permit as necessary in 2014 to continue to operate on coal, the company would be allowed to continue to operate. If we don't get the permit that allows us to continue to operate as a coal-fired plant through December 17, the company will be entitled to request, and the parties have agreed not to oppose, a deferred accounting order for the revenue requirement impact of that event. The potential recovery from customers will be pursuant to a commission order in a future rate case. And the parties may contest recovery of those costs, notwithstanding their agreement not to oppose the deferred accounting treatment. Moving on to a discussion of revenue energy credits. This is paragraph 29. Base REC revenue rates for the REC balancing account purposes will be set at $2 million. That's a Utah allocated number. Effective with the September 1st rate increase, step one rate increase on September 1 of 2014. They will continue at this level until they are set through a subsequent general rate case filing on or after January 1 of 2016. The $2 million base REC amount in base rates is net of the 10% incentive per paragraph 39 of the stipulation in docket 11-035-200. and the REC balancing account mechanisms will continue to operate on their normal schedule. Moving to a discussion of the energy and balance market, this is now paragraph 30. The parties request that the commission enter a deferred accounting order to permit the company to begin to defer Utah's allocated portion of energy and balance market, or EIM-related operation and maintenance expenses incurred after September 1, 2014, and depreciation expense related to capital investments necessary to implement EIM recorded on or after September 1, 2014. These will be dealt with for recovery in a future case pursuant to commission order in that case. Again, any EM deferred costs should be determined in a future case, and the parties may contest recovery of those costs, notwithstanding their agreement not to oppose a deferred accounting of those issues now. Moving on to paragraph 31, the parties agree that any deferred EIM-related labor costs will be limited to positions that are exclusively created as a result of the company's participation in the energy and balance market that are in excess of the full-time equivalent employees that were reflected in the company's direct finding in this case. The next paragraph talks about the timing of the next rate case. The company agrees that it will not file a general rate case or a major plan addition case or seek otherwise a rate increase in Utah prior to January 1st, 2016, with an effective date prior to September 1st of 2016. The step two increase in this docket and other accretion approved and currently existing adjustment mechanisms are exempt from that provision. Moving on to cost of service rate spread and rate design portion of the stipulation, paragraph 32 indicates that the step one and step two rate increases set forth above shall be allocated as set forth in Exhibit C and D to this stipulation. Exhibit C and D also include the monthly comparisons for step one and step two rate changes. Special contract rates are not established by this stipulation. They will be governed by the terms of the applicable contract approved by the commission. Moving on to paragraph 34, the residential customer charge should be increased to $6 per month for single-phase residential customers and $12 a month for three-phase residential customers until there is a change to the customer charge established by a commission order. The remainder of the revenue requirement increase assigned to Schedules 1, 2, and 3 should be applied to the Tier 2 winter rates for the residential class. And in Step 2, the Schedule 1 rate increase will also be applied to Tier 2 winter rates. Moving on to paragraph 35, parties agree that the residential minimum bill should be $8 a month for single-phase residential customers and $16 a month for three-phase residential customers. Moving on to paragraph 36, as I had alluded to earlier, no agreement was reached with regard to net metering facilities charge proposed by the company in this filing. Exhibit D that's provided with the stipulation shows the impact to residential rates design under two scenarios. The first scenario showing the residential rate design assuming that the company's proposed net metering facilities charge is adopted and put in place, and another example showing the Utah residential rates assuming that charge is excluded and not approved. Parties agree that the outcome could be different from either of these two scenarios after the net metering phase of the case is completed, but the same process will continue, that the residential rate will reflect whatever any facility charge, if any, is adopted by the commission in this case. As it relates to rate schedule 6, a facilities charge has been created for rate schedule 6 and 6B. Evidently, they've taken the current power charge and separated that between a facilities charge and a power charge. The step one revenue requirement increase for Schedule 6 will be applied to both the power charge and the facilities charge, and the Step 2 revenue requirement increase for rate Schedule 6 will be applied to the power charge only. And those are also shown in Exhibit C to the stipulation. The EBA and RBA rates, which are Schedules 94 and 98, as they apply to Schedule 6 and 6B, will be recalculated so that the previously allocated and collected amounts will be revised to collect those amounts based on the new power charge only. So it will collect the same amount of revenues, but just be applied to a different element of the bill, so that rate will change to accommodate that. That rate will stay in place until new EBA and RBA rates are set. And the compliance finding that Rocky Mountain Power will make with this case and with this stipulation will reflect those changes to the EBA rates for rate Schedule 6 at that time. Speaking of Schedule 31, Exhibit C also reflects the agreed-upon rates for Schedule 31 that were reached by the parties in the stipulation in Docket 13035-196, which will be discussed later this morning. Moving on to just some of the other items in the stipulation, the parties agreed to admit all of the pre-filed testimony into evidence. And the parties also are very clear that the admission of testimony into evidence does not represent an agreement by the parties to any position taken in such testimony. Paragraph 39 states that the stay-out provisions discussed in paragraph 32 above will not prevent Rocky Mountain Power from seeking deferred accounting orders for cost-related or the impacts of disposition through the sale, closure, or other means of the Deer Creek mine and related mining assets, or the impact of the possible sale of the company's ownership interest in the Craig and Hayden generating plants. Again, an agreement to not oppose deferred accounting does not represent any position by the companies to be taken on those deferred accounting orders. Paragraph 40 to 44 just contain information about certain pieces of information that the company has agreed to file with its next general rate case filing. So moving on to the general terms and conditions of the stipulation, the remaining paragraphs contain the general terms and conditions which are associated with most stipulations presented before the commission. They represent the obligations of the party both to the stipulation and to each other as the stipulation is being processed and approved. Let me just point out a couple of items. As with most stipulations, this agreement was reached through negotiation, and there's a fair amount of compromise from the parties in the final agreement. While all of the parties agree that the rate increase and the resolutions of the deferred accounting dockets, each party, again, got there in a different way, and they may have used different assumptions, different valuations, and different adjustments. That's typical of many stipulations. And with that background, the parties agree that this stipulation on a whole is just and reasonable and in the public interest. The stipulation is an integrated whole, and any party may withdraw from it if it's not approved without material change or condition by the commission.
Mr. Taylor, do you have any final comments?
I want to thank the parties for working together to reach an agreement that works for all of the parties. As with most settlements, getting here took a lot of hard work from everybody involved, so I appreciate that. I want to restate the company's support for the stipulation. It's negotiated in good faith by the parties, and I believe the stipulation is in the public interest, and I recommend that the commission approve the stipulation as it was filed. And that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Ms. Schmidt.
Thank you. Just a couple of preliminary questions. Dr. Powell, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm employed by the Division of Public Utilities. I'm the manager of the energy section.
As manager of the energy section, did you participate in this docket, including the settlement?
Yes, I did.
Could you please, do you have a statement to provide concerning the stipulation?
Yes, a brief one.
Please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity and the patience to listen to us this morning. If I could draw your attention to paragraph 2, I'll be fairly brief in my comments. Mr. Taylor for the company has gone through this stipulation in quite a bit of detail. But it says here in paragraph 2, the parties represent, and this includes the division, that this stipulation is just and reasonable in result, et cetera, et cetera, will result in rates that are just and reasonable. And the division recommends that the commission adopt the stipulation as being in the public interest as it's been filed. I would like to just make a few comments on some of the terms and conditions of the stipulation that led the division to agree and to sign the stipulation. The division believes that the compromises that you see or the results in the stipulation are reasonable compromises of the issues that were raised by various parties in the case. Overall, we believe that the rates contained in the stipulation are just and reasonable and in the public interest. If we could set aside for just a second the return on equity, the revenue requirement is approximately, or at least the division believes that the revenue requirement that's represented in the stipulation is approximately where our SIR rebuttal position would have been. We did withdraw a couple of our adjustments in our rebuttal testimony, and based on the company's rebuttal testimony, there were likely other adjustments that we would have withdrawn on SIR rebuttal testimony. The cost, and I'll come back to the return on equity in just a minute. The cost of service and the rate design, other than a few issues that Mr. Taylor pointed out, are pretty much status quo, which we think is a reasonable outcome in this particular case. As the commission is aware, there's ongoing discussions at the state level on interjurisdictional allocations. Those are scheduled to be concluded sometime in the next year, in 2015. And we thought it would be premature at this time to make any radical changes on the class cost of service with the anticipation, or with the possibility, I should say, that we would have to make further changes in the next rate case based on the outcome of those discussions at the state levels. We did implement in Schedule 6, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, a facilities charge, which we reviewed the bill impacts, which are included in the exhibits to the stipulation, and we find those bill impacts are reasonable for that particular class. From the division's point of view, if you look at the rate spread, there was some movement to full cost of service by some rate schedules, and we believe that this is a good outcome of the stipulation. Moving back to the rate of return for just a second, it's probably not too mysterious or not too surprising that the division in isolation would have never agreed to a 9.8 rate of return in this particular case. However, we did evaluate some of the other terms and conditions and believe that the 9.8 is well balanced with the outcomes of those particular terms. We calculated that if the company were to file a rate case, for example, in 2015, that there are approximately $21 million worth of capital additions. That's a revenue requirement value that we know about today. These include the Seeger to Red Butte transmission line and other capital additions that were in the rate case, in this particular rate case, for only part of the test year. Obviously, there would have been other capital additions in a 2015 rate case that the company would have brought forward also. We also note that the company anticipates that the Seeger to Red Butte line will be completed and in service in June of 2015, but yet the stipulation delays the amortization or the collection of those revenue requirement costs until September, or when the line actually does come into place, whichever date is later. That would basically conclude my supporting comments for the stipulation at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Powell. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you. Ms. Beck, would you please state your title for the record?
I'm the director of the Office of Consumer Services.
And as the director, I'm going to presume that you directed and oversaw the preparation of testimony and participated in the settlement on behalf of the office in this case.
Yes, I did.
Do you have a position statement from the office about the stipulation?
Yes, I do. The office reviewed all aspects of this case and submitted testimony of 7 witnesses in the areas of cost of capital, revenue requirement, net power costs, cost of service, and residential rate design. The office also participated in all settlement discussions on behalf of the customers it represents, specifically the residential schedules, irrigators taking service under Schedule 10, and small commercial Schedule 23 customers. My purpose today is to speak in favor of the settlement before the commission. I will first address the revenue requirement increase. The parties agreed upon an increase of $35 million to occur on September 1, 2014, if approved. The office believes that this $35 million is a reasonable outcome for this case, given the evidence presented in this case and recent relevant commission orders. Although the office's initial position included a negative revenue requirement, additional evidence became known through testimony and discovery that allows us to support the $35 million increase, which is, of course, substantially lower than what the company originally requested. Next, I'd like to address the concept and specifics of a two-step rate increase. The office believes that any rate increase coming from this case, or really any one case, must be supported by evidence presented within that particular case. The step two rate increase here of $19.2 million, scheduled for September 1, 2015, is tied both in calculation and implementation to the Sigurd Red Butte transmission line, and the supporting evidence for which is included in this case at hand. The office believes that it is in the public interest to agree to the increase associated with this increase rather than have the company pursue a full general rate case next year. The office supports the rate spread included in the stipulation as representing a reasonable compromise among a wide range of competing cost of service proposals. The office notes that the settlement moves all customer classes in the direction towards closer alignment with actual costs to serve those classes. The office specifically focused its analysis on the residential, irrigator, and small commercial classes that it represents and testifies that the settlement results in just and reasonable rates for those customers. Finally, I'd like to speak in favor of the residential rate design. The office asserts that the increase in customer charge by $1 to $6 for single-phase customers and a corresponding increase to $12 for three-phase customers is supported by the cost of service evidence put forward by the office. The office recommended and supports the remainder of the increase for the residential class being assigned to the second energy tier for winter rates. As we noted in a prior case where a second energy tier was first implemented for winter, the rate was deliberately set lower due to gradualism. The outcome of this case will bring the second tier winter rate much closer to the second tier summer rate. The office is pleased with the residential rate design outcome and asserts the resulting price signals and bill impacts to be fair, reasonable, and consistent with key rate design principles. Of course, the office notes that a key element of the residential rate design is left to be determined at next month's hearing, of course, that being net metering. Other important elements of the stipulation include the company's agreement regarding the timing of the filing of NPC updates and also the agreement to complete and file a marginal cost study in the next general rate case. In conclusion, in the office's view, the settlement is in the public interest and will result in just and reasonable rates. Thus, we recommend commission approval.
Thank you, Ms. Beck. Earlier, it was determined that there wouldn't be any questions for the panel except from the commission, but if the statements have altered any party's position on that, now's the time to speak up. So in hearing no comment, we'll turn to the commission. Any questions for the witnesses? I have a couple of questions. And I'm going to direct these to the panel at large, but Mr. Taylor, probably it would be efficient if you'd begin the responses to these. First, regarding paragraph 21, which addresses the Sigurd to Red Butte transmission line investment. Paragraph 21 states that this investment is prudent and that cost recovery will occur in the step two rate change. That characterization, does that apply to the investment as it exists today, to the investment as it will exist at the conclusion of construction? How do the parties interpret this statement?
I believe that statement says that the cost of the line as they were presented in this case by Rocky Mountain Power, which is a projection of what those costs will be upon completion, that level of cost was found to be prudent. And but any cost recovery that will not begin until the step two.
And is Mr. Taylor's clarification there consistent with the understanding of the division in the office?
Yes, it is with our understanding. I would add to what Mr. Taylor has said is, given our position that we took in the CPCN for the Sigurd to Red Butte section, we also had division analysts that reviewed the costs of the line in the rate case, and our consultant also reviewed those costs. And so we agree with Mr. Taylor's characterization of those.
Thank you. Ms. Beck, anything to add?
We agree as well.
Thank you. And in the event that the construction is completion of construction is delayed beyond September 1st, 2015, is there a process for informing the commission and the parties as to the date of completion? Have you thought about that, Mr. Taylor?
Oh, I don't know that there was a formal process laid out in the stipulation, but we will certainly inform all the participants if, number one, we believe there is a delay and what the anticipated in-service date is. We will also inform them the date upon which it goes into service. I just will say at this point, we fully expect the line to be in service well before September 1 of 2015.
Okay. Thank you. Now, inviting you to look at paragraph 27 for a couple of moments. The dockets referred to in the first sentence, which each pertain to a deferral balance. Am I correct in understanding that absent this provision, the recovery of those balances would have been achieved on or before November 1st, 2014?
I don't believe that's the case. I think some of them would extend beyond that date. And so what we've agreed to here is the remaining balance as of November of 14 will then be combined and amortized over 1 year. The intent of that is they all have staggered ending dates, which results in a number of rate changes throughout the next couple of years. This is just to simplify that into one collection period.
And as the parties discussed this provision, was there any kind of rough understanding of what the cumulative effect of this might be? I mean, I recognize that some of these values are still prospective.
One moment.
Sure. Let's be off the record. Pardon me just a second. On the record.
Yeah, those amounts of those different amortization periods were discussed in Mr. Stephen McDougall's testimony in the currently pending EBA docket, and so that information is contained there.
Thank you. Now to paragraph 30. The first sentence begins, the parties agree that the commission may enter a deferred accounting order. And my question really just addresses the word may. Is it that the parties are hesitant to direct the commission to do something, but that you intend that in order to effectuate the parties' intents related to the stipulation that the commission will implement this? Or is this truly discretionary for the commission within the contemplated meaning of the stipulation?
It's Rocky Mountain Power's understanding that the commission will. However, we're always reluctant to specifically direct the commission to do things.
Okay. And is that?
I think that was it. It was just a caution not to appear to be telling the commission what they had to do. But the intent was is that the commission would enter into a deferred accounting order and allow the company to start deferring those costs subject to the conditions laid out here.
Ms. Beck, anything to add to that? No. And so is it the approval of the stipulation that will that would constitute in the parties' minds the approval of the deferred accounting order? I mean, assuming our order mentions that in some way, or was there some further process contemplated by the parties?
No, I believe that approval of the stipulation with a specific statement by the commission to that effect would be adequate.
That would be acceptable to us.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions based on mine? That concludes my questions. Is there anything else to come before the commission at this time?
Mr. Commissioner, I have one point of administrative business, I suppose. The office provided testimony in this present docket, in the 1335-184 docket, and specifically testimony from Mr. Gimble and Chernick that were filed under the cover of the 184 docket. Intermingled with that testimony is Schedule 31, 196 related testimony. And so as testimony in the 1335-184 docket is accepted into the record as stipulated by the parties, I would need and ask for the commission to also take Mr. Gimble's and Mr. Chernick's testimony that was filed under the 184 cover into the 196 docket. I recognize that not all of it will be directly related to the 196, but due to the intertwined nature of the testimony, I think if that's acceptable to the commission, I would make that humble request.
Is there any objection to that? We will do as you've asked, Mr. Coleman.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Consider the testimony in the appropriate docket. And if that applies to any other witnesses who are addressing both of these dockets, we'll take the same approach there. Anything further in this docket? Then just before we conclude, let me acknowledge on behalf of the commission our understanding, at least to some level, of the great effort that it takes to, on all the parties' parts, to negotiate and achieve a stipulation in a case as complex as this one is. And we appreciate the diligence and the contributions of all the participants in the proceeding. Thank you very much. With that, we'll turn our attention to the stipulation in docket number 13035196. And let's take a We'll be in recess until 10 after 10, and everyone can take that opportunity to get the right paper in front of them, and we'll be recessed for 7 minutes. Thank you.